Welcome to Raw and Real Entrepreneurship, the show that dares to bring no-nonsense insight to those who have the courage to start, grow, and scale a business. I'm your host, Susan Sly. Well, hey, what's up, Raw and Real Entrepreneurs, wherever you are in the world. I hope you're having an amazing day and out there crushing it, going for your goals. So I have a question for you. Have you thought about raising money or funding an idea, or even maybe you've been confused? What does M&A even mean? And it's not like an M&M, my friends. Like it does have a different meaning. My guest today is an expert. And I admit I kind of, you know, stalked him a little bit because there are different people in this space. But the reality is that he's one of the good ones and he is super cool. So check this out. He is the founder and CEO of M&A Science with a passion to drive the M&A industry forward. He was an M&A advisor for 10 years in which he sold larger companies such as commercial banks and hotel chains. In 2012, he noticed teams lacked efficient technology to manage deals, and he created Deal Room, thank God, an M&A lifecycle management platform. In 2016, he started the M&A Science podcast, devoting his time to create a platform where all the best practitioners could share their best practices and lessons learned from real life deals. Keysan then created the M&A Science Academy in 2020 to offer step-by-step training to those looking to master M&A, featuring courses created by top-level practitioners. Through developing technology, educational talent, and industry training, he aims to bring better practices to the industry with growing market pressures, I'll say, transaction values, and competition. So my guest today is the one and only dad of three, Keysan Patel. Keysan, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Susan. Nice to be speaking with you.
Well, for those of you listening, Raw and Real Entrepreneurship, Keysan and I were off to a late start. You all know we chat offline, and I'm in the middle of a real estate acquisition, so I'm trying to navigate where I'm actually going to do my show for the next 6 weeks. So that's a whole different discussion, but Keysan was so gracious, and he's professionally set up. So he, if you're seeing this on YouTube, he looks amazing, and I am, you know, it is what it is. It's raw and real, but the show must go on. So Keysan, first and foremost, let me ask you, what was the first business you ever started?
The first business I started was a tobacco shop when I was 13 years old from my locker in junior high school. At the time there was a big demand for tobacco products, and interesting enough, because of the limitations to access those products, there was a higher markup. So it was, margins were really good.
Wow. Of all the 300 shows I've done, that was the first time I ever heard that as a startup. So, let me ask this question then. So, how did you avoid getting caught?
I think eventually I did get caught. You know, I just remember I had immigrant parents. I was a junior high school. It's right around 12th grade, right? You get into the little cliques of junior high. And I didn't have nice clothes. I had two pairs of Wrangler jeans and I had three shirts, one of them of which was pink. So if you can imagine what I wore every Wednesday. And I just wanted nicer clothes to fit in with the cool kids. And the cool kids are out trying to smoke cigarettes and be cool. And then the rock kids, the guys that chain smoke cigarettes and listen to Metallica, they had plenty of supply to all these cigarette products. And next thing you know, you got a little business trying to meet the demand with supplies.
Wow. So you learned about supply and demand early on. What else did you learn from that business that you might still be applying in business today?
Persistence. It was just persistence. It was always getting things done. When you ran out of product, you got to go run and get more. When prices go up, you got to figure out how to handle it. When competition showed up, there is a competitor that was selling cigarettes, and you have to handle that and be competitive.
So was the next business you started? So as you forayed out of the cigarette tobacco business in school, then you go off and, start your life. What was the first sort of, I guess, what people would say legitimate business? However, I've had 12-year-old founders on the show who are producing products. Shadi has a cosmetics business. I had another one who does reviews on YouTube. He's making multiple six figures. So I don't believe there's an age range for a legitimate business, but selling tobacco out of your locker, maybe not legitimate, partially illegal. But what was the first, I guess, quote unquote, legitimate business you started?
There was always something. I remember being 15 years old. I was an early eBay user in 1995 reselling products, which is something I probably should have stuck to, but I would use cell phones in bulk and resell them, buy all these odd products, or sometimes find a product that wasn't marketed well, purchase it, take better photos, better description, and resell it. So then if we skip forward to the legit business, I got into real estate as a broker, but was terrible at selling houses, and found my way to an area I was much more interested in, which was selling businesses, and worked with a little firm that did that to get the experience and know-how, and started a practice consulting with mostly private investors in the beginning to either buy a business or sell a business they already own. Mm-hmm. And that practice evolved over near a decade to working with corporates that were investing and buying hotel assets, or working with financial institutions, big bank buying little banks trying to sell.
Wow. That's an interesting journey. And that it sounds to me too, that there was this self-actualization piece, Kisano. It's like, oh, I might not be so good at this, but I'm really passionate about this particular aspect. And the fact it speaks volumes about who you are as a person, that you said, hey, you know what, I am going to keep going down this road, but have a different, kind of bent to it. So do you think that there are people who are meant to be entrepreneurs and there are people who aren't? Or do you think it's something people can learn?
I think it's a mix of the two. This is almost like with kids, like nature versus nurture. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced it's a variable person to person, right? There's kids that you can really influence well, and there's kids you can't, zero. And I almost feel like there's a knack with that, with being an entrepreneur. There's skills you need to develop along the way, period, that you learn. Some people learn it through experience. Some people can get really book smart. Some people use a combination of the two. And then there's this sort of wired drive that you have to go out and get it and push for it, overcome all these pitfalls and stumbles and get back up and move until you get it. Which I think there's a little bit of that. And I've been asking myself the same question, Susan, can you teach somebody to truly be an entrepreneur? And part of that is this drive that you get in the morning where you fire yourself up, when you can really get yourself on that A game and saying, from the moment you wake up, it's time to play the game. And you're objectively out disciplining yourself, getting comfortable doing these things you're uncomfortable doing, so you can achieve the things that you want on a daily basis. You don't see the big progress, but you're committed to it and are going to go through the rigor to make sure you don't ever slow down or stop. So I don't know. I'm curious and want to figure that out, because I even look at my own kids and I can tell some of them, they're very influenceable and they've got that drive. I got an 11-year-old daughter who has her own business, putting a plug in for her, but she runs her own business selling jewelry online. It's like Fuego, but it's Fueglo. And she's, so she's got it. But then I look at the two boys I have and I'm like, I don't know. I refer to her as the heir and those two as the spare. Like, they just video games and that's it. They don't, I don't know. They don't have that kind of,
she's the oldest though, isn't she?
She is.
That's, yeah. So they've got some time, Kisan. I want to have her on the show. I love young founders, because for this show, in so many countries, but I get a lot of people writing in saying, I listen to you in the car with my kids, because we never swear on the show, or we edit it out if someone does. But I, that next generation of entrepreneurs, and thinking about what they're seeing on social media, and they're seeing younger people starting businesses. So to your point, is it nature versus nurture? Or if I go, I've traveled and worked in 33 countries in the world. And if I go, whether it's Guatemala, Phnom Penh, or anywhere that, you know, say in the developing world, kids are out there hustling, they're selling flowers, they're selling, you know, and it's not necessarily for the most healthy of reasons, but they're out there, they're learning how to sell, they're learning how to close, they're learning how to be persistent. And it's just a way of life in certain places. And I think perhaps in certain countries, and definitely in America, that selling has become, you know, a dirty word, and entrepreneurship, as enticing as it is, we know the statistic. In America, 62% of people want to start businesses, 91% of them never do it.
Yep. That is true.
So when someone, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I'm go ahead. It's fine.
Yeah. So when someone is, you know, in terms of buying and selling businesses, I had the founder of FreshBooks on the show, and you know, that FreshBooks has grown into a unicorn. So it has $1 billion+ valuation. He started in his basement, and we got into a friendly debate. And if, you know, someone's listening, they haven't heard that show, it's a really intriguing show, how he started that company. But, you know, we get into this debate. It's a friendly debate. In my opinion, and you can, I want to hear your opinion. I feel when people are starting a business, they need to start with the end in mind, right? So at Radius, we said, you know, the founders, it's myself and four guys. So it's like me and four brothers. It's crazy in this AI company. But we said our goal is to be acquired. And we were all unified around that initial goal. In my opinion, you have to know in the beginning how you want to exit, because that changes structure. It changes who you hire, how you hire, how you do certain things. And that's my thought, but you might feel differently. Do you think when someone's starting a business, they should really think about how they want to exit at the very beginning?
I didn't do that. I think of what drives you, right? When you think of an exit, what's driving that? Is it purely to get a big check? Or are you really mission driven in the impact you're trying to make with your business? And for us, we wanted to change the way mergers and acquisitions happen dramatically. Right now, this industry operates on a system designed purely around the financial basis of doing M&A. And when we look at the real world, what happens to make M&A successful, it's all about aligning teams to work together and align around priorities to be able to achieve these big lofty goals, and to create that capability of enabling teams to achieve these big lofty goals is completely different than just financial analysis. And we wanted to change that emphasis from this finance focus to a real people focused in our industry. And when that happens, and we see that as the majority way of doing deals, we're going to see big financial impacts at the end result, but we're going to see motivated, happy people. A lot of times we see these big headline news and we follow up with a bunch of layoffs, but more of the attrition, people actually quitting their jobs because they're tired of dealing with the change and a lot of headaches and frustrations that come about it when it's not handled in a good way. So that's where, when we look at our company goals with this business, there's a big mission that's driving it. And when you have that, that's what you're going after. So I'm more about having a mission that's really something you can stick to. Even the podcast that we started 5 years ago, we didn't just start a podcast. We wanted to create a platform to enable our industry practitioners to be able to share their lessons learned. Our industry operates in a silo. Everybody's got such a unique way of thinking about M&A. There's no standardizations or best practices anywhere. Every other industry does. We don't. And why not create this platform so we get a voice that practitioners can share their lessons, and then we in turn document it. We analyze patterns of these lessons learned and really look for those best practices, real proven ways of doing things, and then have created frameworks and things. But that we're able to continue with this high momentum because we have this mission. This is what we want to do. We want to create this impact. We want to show the industry the right way to do these deals.
Well, and you're, you know, when by the time someone's in an M&A situation, their business has been going for a while. Right. And I know when in all of the pitches I've done and the startups I mentor, investors will often ask, what's your exit plan? Is it IPO? Are you selling? What are you doing? By the time someone comes to you, that person, that business is in such a different state. So I want you to imagine someone who's listening right now, and they're about to go on this journey of starting a company. And they hope and pray, Keysan, that someday they get to work with someone like you who has the best intentions for that business and the most benevolent outcome. So let me flip the script for a minute, because now you've interviewed all of these people. You know best practices. You also know worst practices. So what should people be afraid of when it comes to M&A by fear? What I'm talking about is someone who doesn't have the best interest for that company at heart. Like, what would be some of those indicators that maybe they should run?
You know, it's a lot of the don't knows, what it all comes down to when you go after a deal. And you can be on either the buy or sell side. But if I was selling a business, it's, what do I not know? I don't know anything about this company, what they're trying to do, and this and that. And the more you can learn and really find that there's good answers, they actually have a good rationale, a good reason, a good theme of what they're trying to do. It's the stuff that you keep asking, you don't know, and you still don't know after asking. That's when you really got to feather a bit and reconsider whether it makes sense to move forward. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the big thing, is you got to have clarity. The more clarity you have, the better you'll understand, the better you'll be able to align and have that confidence that things will actually come together. The more don't knows you have, that's leaves things to the real. And that's why it's so more proactive you are. At the end of the day, it's a big exercise. Change management, it's a big learning curve to come with it. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do that at a pretty big expense. So mm-hmm. How do you overcome it? It's by learning as much as you can. The more you learn, the more... And you're going to still make a lot of mistakes. I think that's the biggest challenge of doing M&A. It's very complex in what you need to do to get the deal done, but then to actually realize the value from the transaction is extremely complex, because you're driving this large magnitude of change to an organization that most of the employees working there didn't choose it, didn't get a vote or say in all this change that needs to be driven to really get the value of the company, which is likely going to involve an integration of the business so they can realize cost synergies and revenue synergies. We'll learn some M&A terms, but cost synergies usually involves reducing costs, headcount reduction, combining systems and so forth. And then your revenue synergies, and how you're going to expand the revenues. Are both sales teams going to cross-sell each other's products? Are we bringing their product into our new market? What are we doing to increase revenues? And those things to act on and capture the intended and forecasted value on those activities, that's really hard to do while keeping people happy, motivated.
Hmm. So in that, you know, that's speaking from the company that is going through it, or the even from the employees and their perspective, because we've seen a lot of bad M&As where a company's been acquired and then suddenly, to your point, 3,000 people are laid off, or there's so many changes that the core values of that company that existed aren't there in the next iteration. What I want to know is the M&A people themselves. When you are considering an M&A and you're looking for iBankers or M&A specialists, what are some of the warning signs that you should run? Because just like there are bad realtors, there are bad, you know, mortgage brokers, there are all sorts of people who are bad actors in a good industry. And let's face it, Keysan, M&A sometimes gets a bad rap. iBankers get a bad rap. Like in my world, I've dealt with a lot of iBankers. I've dealt with a lot of, you know, VCs and different people. So what would be some warning signs that someone, if they're on this journey, they should run away?
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason for that. There are a lot of bad bankers out there. So it is important to be able to vet them well. It goes back to even the business. You want to do your diligence. You want to ask a lot of questions and uncover information. I think it's seeing their nature as well. Are they doing the same with you? Are they spending a lot of time to understand what your goals and objectives are? Because if they're really prodding about their capabilities, that might be a signal right there. You know, if they're digging in and really understanding why you're looking to sell a company and the real rationale behind it, because otherwise you're just looking at it as here's a templated process. I'm just trying to maximize the dollars, but there might be other things beyond that, that you really have this living, breathing organization with people that are like family to you. And what are your goals for them? To really get a sense of what that looks like, because that ties into the bigger picture of the deal. Because it's just more than the financials there. I think that's the real big thing that somebody would focus on. I think there's, you know, it's like testing them out, right? Because every banker is going to say they have this experience in the industry and things like that. And obviously you want to find the stuff that's correlated, right? Have they sold similar types of companies in the industry? Things like that, get the sense of the track record. But then really figure out like some of the transparency, because a lot of times you want to understand when you're working with an advisor, you're getting a banker, you're getting access to a pool of potential buyers. And you really want to understand the depth of those relationships that they have with that network that they're marketing to you, as in terms of that's a capability is providing you access to the best breed of buyers out in the market so you can have the best suited transaction that runs well. And you need to be able to test that capability, because do they pull up a list from a database or do they actually know these people? So can you test them on that? Say, hey, you know Jim over there? Can we, then let's get a conversation going and really figure that out. If you can also talk to some of the CEOs of companies they've transacted with in the past, you know, are they a little reserved about making some introductions to formal clients, or are they really forthcoming about it and can let you take your pick of the litter? Going back to the buying a business, you got to do a lot of diligence. When you're selling your business and working with your vendors, you should do a lot of diligence. Maybe they got to check out their Glassdoor reviews and things like that.
That's great advice. And the thing I think about too are sometimes there are clauses that people are not aware of. So as an example, you sign up with an iBanker, but you find out that iBanker has put a clause in, you didn't read the agreement, that even if they don't bring the acquisition partner, they still get a percentage of the deal. Right. And there are all sorts of things that I think people, it's like buyer beware, that they really want to think about, because that, you know, selling your business is like selling your baby in a way, right? You've spent all this time, you've curated, you have these people that you love and care about, and whoever handles that transaction, you really need to read the fine print. And to your point, I love what you said. It's like, do your homework, do your research, and really know, because I've seen a lot of people go into deals and they're like, where did those millions and millions and millions go? Well, you signed an agreement and that iBanker took a large chunk of it. Were you not aware that that was going to happen? Right. And you hear about these exits, especially like Silicon Valley. It's like, oh, they had this exit for $1 billion. It doesn't mean that founder got $1 billion. A lot of that pie went to different people. So switching gears, as a dad, and especially as a daughter who's an entrepreneur, in terms of this next generation of entrepreneurs, let's call them Gen Alpha entrepreneurs, what do you think, in your opinion, what are some of the things that you're seeing in terms of how they do business or their attitude toward business that perhaps our generation doesn't have?
It's interesting because they get exposed to so much information at such an early age. And if they learn to harness it, they can go off on their own and do quite a bit, especially the way technology is evolving. It's more about enabling less sophisticated people basically to be able to build technology, like the no code theme, right? You don't need to know how to code to build software anymore. You have so many platforms that allow you to do that. And that's what's really cool. My daughter uses Shopify. She runs it herself. She's dad, back up. I got this. You don't need your help. And she figures it out on her own. So I think there's a lot of things like that where there's so much access to the information and tools that they can actually execute at such an early age. So I see it. It's just the drive, the motivation, that's becoming a bit rare. The attention span is becoming a bit rare. So I think those are the things that needs to overcome. It's just to encourage it, put some light on it that, hey, these are good things for kids to do, is to venture off, try new things, and build commerce, understand how the world operates by the ability to create value versus just putting funny videos or disturbing videos online.
Yeah, disturbing. That's a whole other thing as a parent. My youngest one doesn't even have a phone. We won't let her have one. She's 12. And at the school she was at before, the kids were getting $1,200 iPhones when they were literally, Kisan, 7 or 8 years old. And, she was the only one in her class who doesn't have a phone. We moved her to a different school, and she's not the only one who doesn't have a phone. And she still codes and she does all of this cool stuff. But I'm like, you don't have the emotional maturity for social media yet. And so let's just not go there until you're ready. But I think it's very interesting what they're exposed to. What's something in your business that you do, but maybe it's not your favorite thing to do, but you do it anyway?
Something in business that I basically don't like to do, but I do it anyways. It's things have changed quite a bit, where when I ran a consulting practice, I liked doing the modeling. Like, I really liked getting into the finances and building out projections, all that stuff, doing the nitty gritty work. I don't know if that was just a break of not dealing with people, but now I don't like doing any of that stuff at all, but it's something I have to do. Mm-hmm. I have to have this economic sense to make sure that the company's balanced and we're investing in the right areas and things of that sort. But when the business grows, it really changed quite a bit. I was very challenged with leadership in the early years of creating this business. I focused a lot on developing those skills, reading books on it, which wasn't actually the most helpful. It was more the organizational psychology books. But focusing on those areas, and then later presentation skills, communication. So it shifted, and now I'm very much focused on those components and helping improve or develop the talent in our organization in those areas so everybody can improve. And then I still have to do the finances, but yeah.
Yeah, thank you for your honesty on that, because so often entrepreneurs will say, oh, I like to do everything. And I'm like, no, you don't. There are certain things. I don't like firing people. You know? I don't like doing it, right? There are certain things that social media, I don't like doing it, but I put on my social media hat and it's like, okay, doing it, right? So there are certain things that, are an essential part to business, but we don't always like doing them. And that's why it's raw and real entrepreneurship, because we talk about what's raw and real.
It's discipline. Like, isn't that fair to teach kids that, hey, this is how the world operates. You're going to have to do things you don't like to do, and you may get comfortable doing them. I didn't like giving presentations, public speaking, but now I've become comfortable doing it and actually don't mind to enjoy it. But we don't learn that as a skill, that you can transform yourself. And that's part of the skill that you want to create that allows you to be successful. Because when you have that discipline, all of a sudden you got quite a bit of versatility in which you can accomplish in this world. Because it doesn't have to be necessarily the stuff you like. You can objectively do these things from the moment you wake up and find that, I don't know if you heighten your own internal burning desire of what you want to achieve for the day, but to be able to do that and execute on it, that's what it really boils down to. Mm-hmm. Children, let's learn, if you can teach that at an early age, that goes back to the early question. Can you really teach it? Because if we can, we definitely can refocus a lot of our efforts right there and create a better place in the world.
Yeah, that's so true. Like that discipline. I grew up in so my family immigrated. They were immigrants to Canada, my dad's family. So I grew up with a very strict father, Kisan, and my grandmother in a Chinese restaurant. So it didn't matter how I was feeling. I was folding napkins. I was taking people to their table. I was making egg rolls in the kitchen. Like, it didn't matter how you're feeling. My grandmother was like, no time for feelings. Just do it. Just work. And I don't think that's healthy either. So I want to ask you the last question is, let's talk about this concept of this pull and this push, because so many people get into entrepreneurship because they want freedom. That's actually the number one reason people become entrepreneurs, because they want to feel free. However, we know all of the statistics show the average entrepreneur works approximately 15% more hours during the week than an employee. And it's even probably more than that since the pandemic. So you're a dad, you have three kids. In your opinion, like, how do people maintain some semblance of balance, I guess, while they're growing businesses and have families?
It's tough. You know, the funny thing I've been doing recently, Susan, is bringing in some of the business elements at home, like trying to have a State of the Union address in the beginning of the year with the family.
Okay. I want to hear about that.
I got a friend with one of the guys. I'm trying to blank on his name. I talked to him last year and he was telling me about it. And I was like, that's such a good idea. I should do that. And it was so fun because I said, hey, let's talk about it. Let's recap the year, talk about what we achieved this past year. And then I had each of my kids write out their goals for this coming year. And we like wrote it out and say, all right, we're committed to going after these goals this year. And they got to really collaborate, talk to each other about it. What are some of the bigger family goals that we can do together? You know, we've got the Disney World trip and things like that on there. So that I think is, and I think there's how you use your time, because you can be in the same room as your kid and be like, oh, and then he's watching TV, the other kid's on the iPad. Like that quality isn't there. I think if you can balance it or manage it to be really proactive about it. And something I'm continually working on to really say, hey, we're going to actually do things together. I think we forget that sometimes as parents, where it's like, hey, I got to take care of this kid. Well, no, we do have some core responsibilities as a parent to feed the child healthy and educate them. So, and you got to be proactive about that. Mm-hmm. You got to be spending time to educate them, but education is so different. You know, there's the stages you go through as a kid. In the early stages, there's no rationale or compromise. You know, and I think we forget about that. You can't constantly be, don't do this, don't do that. You know, it's actually all about listening and understanding. And so I think that's where being a parent develops you, because you knew now shift and emphasize your effort to really listen and understand. And that's actually how you really connect with the child in a really proactive way. And it gives you this opportunity to relive your youth. And I think we forget that as parents, that I get to go back and really try to embrace what this experience was like as an adult, you know, from those years, and even getting back to like playing with Legos is pretty fun. Like, we can build all kinds of things and really go back into it. And even the sports, I learned how to ice skate a couple of years ago because the kids want to learn. It's like, well, I'm not going to be a sideline parent. Now it's an activity the whole family does together. And it's the best thing because I don't have to worry about that. Throw them on the ice and everybody takes care of themselves and stay out of trouble. So it works out really well. I think that's the thing you got to do to really balance it is make your time quality time together. I remember seeing this family when I was leaving a hotel, and I just could feel the energy of how connected this family was. And I paused and asked the mom, I said, there's something really special about your family. I can just tell you have such a tight bond. What is it? And she told me, it's like, well, it was because we all play softball together. Mm-hmm. I was like, really? She's like, yeah, I don't know. She's like, it's just, we have this thing that we do as a whole family. And because of that, it just really keeps us in such tight momentum together. And I was like, whoa, that kind of stuck out to me. So, but again, it's something like very proactive. You know, we're not just sitting around, but now we're really connecting with each other in such qualitative ways. So I think that's the thing that really allows you to balance it out with the commitment you need as an entrepreneur to have a good balance with your family and make it meaningful.
So what I'm hearing is, I love that. So learning with them, right? Because we're all learning, and especially as entrepreneurs, I mean, we're all learning, learning with them and bringing business in. And so a few years ago, I sat down with the kids and I did a cash flow statement with my husband, who's a CPA, and we presented the cash flow statement for the house with the kids. And they were like, and I was like, this is how much groceries are. This is how much your tuitions are. This is this is how much money comes in. And they're all like, and I had this big flip chart piece on. And so the other thing I do when I take them to the grocery store, I'll have them guess how much is it going to ring up to? And they play this guessing game to bring that concept of financial, you know, good financial governance, but also understanding. And I've brought them to speaking events. When I used to do speaking events with like Jack Canfield and Tony Robbins and all these different people, I'd bring them and, you know, so they'd get that understanding. But the thing that I love that you said, and I'm thinking about this, we used to do every year on Boxing Day, we used to do Lego Day. So we'd bring out all these bins of Lego and we'd have family building championships. I always lost the family building championship. I'm not a gifted Lego builder, but the kids still talk about, when are we doing our next Lego Day? And my kids go from like 12 all the way up to 27. And they're like, when are we doing our next Lego building day?
I like that idea. I appreciate it. I'm going to do that cash flow expense at home. The kids are
going to write letters. And when I have your daughter on the show, she's going to be like, my dad did that.
Oh, we had to calculate the profit margins on lemonade. That was a good exercise.
And will that be, you know, I think I had to, did you have to play an instrument growing up?
No, I was a worthless kid. I didn't do anything. No sports, no instrument.
My being raised in a very Chinese traditional way, so you have to play an instrument, and there's only really two instruments you're allowed to play: the violin and the piano. And there's only you can study to be an engineer. If you're Asian and you're listening, you're probably laughing. So you can be an engineer, you can be a doctor, an attorney or an accountant. Okay, so, but you know, there were all these things that I had to do that taught me discipline. But ask me if I play the piano now. No, I couldn't even read a line of sheet music now. And so I have to think, am I just taking my Tiger Mom stuff I learned and turning it into business stuff now, so my kids don't have to play piano, but they have to know how to do a cash flow statement? So that's maybe something for me to talk about with a therapist or something.
Yeah, I don't. I like it. I'm going to add it to the playbook here.
Well, I like doing the State of the Union. Like, oh my gosh. Well, you know what? Keyson for president. Like, I think a good State of the Union with fiscal responsibility, like, game on for that. You know, so I love it. Well, Keyson, thank you so much for being here. And for everyone, go ahead, go to mnascience.com. That's Keyson's website. Check out his podcast. I am going to be a new listener because I love everything to do with M&A and with, you know, projects that I have on the horizon. I'll be more and more ensconced in that world with my vision to help 1,000 women launch technology companies over the 10 years. So next 10 years. So Keyson, thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure, Susan. Enjoy the conversation.
Well, thank you. All right, Ron Real Entrepreneurs. This has been another episode of Ron Real Entrepreneurship. Go out there and have an amazing day. And I will see you in the next episode. Hey, it's Susan. I want to thank you so much for listening to this episode. If this episode has helped you in any way, please go ahead and give a great review on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, or wherever you listen to this podcast. If this show has really given you some amazing insight, please go ahead and tag me on social at Susan_Sly on Twitter, at Susan Sly on Instagram, and at Susan Sly Live on Facebook. With that, check out more great episodes of Ron Real Entrepreneur, the show where entrepreneurs create their own freedom. With that, God bless, go rock your day, and I will see you in the next episode.